Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Ali Prince, visually impaired DJ, who can normally be found DJing clubs around London, festivals in Italy, and of course, here on RNIB Connect Radio, presenting the Folk and Roots show. Ali's tracks certainly take us on a worldwide journey through his lifelong involvement in music, from times as a mod in the mid-late 60s and early 70s, through the 80s, 90s, and right up to today. Hello, Ali, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, Toby. Thank you very much for asking me.
As someone who's been DJing for a number of years now, and also with your Folk and Roots show on Connect Radio, it must have been quite a tricky task to select your tracks.
It was extremely difficult. So what I decided to do was, rather than pick particular tracks to mark an event, was to pick, apart from the first and last tracks, to pick tracks which sort of represented eras. That's how I did it.
And we're going to start with your teenage life, and I also think with your start of a long-term involvement in music. What was teenage life like for you, and why do you say you have a lifelong involvement in music?
It was good. I had a sort of very liberal upbringing, which is fairly unusual at the time. My parents were pretty laid back, which meant that I actually was able from a pretty young age to go and see quite a lot of live music and things like that. As a parent myself now, I'd probably be a little bit horrified, but we won't go into that too deeply. But I just got really interested in sort of music, and I heard a track on a radio show, and it was called Shout, and it was by a band called Joey D and the Starlighters, who are an American New York-based band. And I thought that sounded interesting, and it was a bit of an oldie, but it sounded interesting. And then I was delving in a huge junk warehouse full of mainly furniture in southeast London with a friend. And there was a little rack of 7-inch singles. And in there was one called Shout by somebody I'd never heard of, or a band I'd never heard of, called the Ugly Brothers. So I bought it. It cost 2 shillings, 10p. And we took it back to his place and put it on. And I won't say what I said exactly, but I said in a very different way, wow. And it was like a road to Damascus. That was it. I was into the music, and that got me into sort of American rhythm and blues and gospel and soul music.
And I think you say that this track is a sort of reflection of your personality. What do you mean by that, and why do you think it is?
It's unorthodox. Remember, when I heard it, I'd heard nothing like this before at all. And in fact, when it first came out, it was very unusual in what it sounded like. And I've always liked to be a little bit different and a little bit unorthodox and sort of carve my own route, if you like, take my own road. And it sort of reflected that in many, many ways. I was a budding mod, and mod music was very much about soul and rhythm and blues, and it sort of fitted in with all of those things as well. So it sort of encapsulated my teenage years, really.
Well, you know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout, come on now, don't forget to say you will.
Shout by the Isley Brothers there. Ali, for your next track, we move to the mid/late 1960s. You were, as you say, a mod during this time. And I wonder what life was actually like back in the late 1960s, as they sort of called it the old swinging 60s back then. And I just wondered, was life really like it is portrayed in the films and books and things?
Yeah, I think the swinging 60s is a little bit of a myth. For most people, it was actually very conservative. and things were starting to change and move forward, but it wasn't quite as swinging as is made out in the movies and the media for vast amounts of the population. But I was really lucky because living in London, I had access to all the music and what was going on, and also I was really interested in it. So the two things gelled well. And for me, it was pretty swinging and pretty good fun. It was great, great fun. I mean, I was at school, then I left school and did my A-levels at college and so on. And all of that college life was really good. Though I didn't like school, it was too conservative. And it sort of worked really well for me, but I think a lot of people actually it was a little bit dull.
As a mod, you must have been into the style and fashion of the time. Was that true?
Oh, very much so. And there were, of course, inevitably, with all groups, there are subgroups. I was a Lambretta mod. I had a Lambretta, and my style was sort of, I guess it was sort of parkas. Obviously, everybody wore parkas and things like that, but I tended to wear sort of tops and trousers and so on, and less suited. Vespa mods are very much into suits, and I tended not to wear suits so much. I mean, I did wear suits, but it was much more sort of, if you like, smart casual rather than the very smart suits in that way. And I really like being a mod. I really enjoyed it, but it sort of fizzled out in the mid-60s, and then I started to grow my hair and become what was later described as a hippie.
What is the track that you have chosen to mark this particular era in your life, and why have you chosen it?
It's a track by a singer called Lorraine Ellison, and it's called Stay With Me Baby. And it's just, it's very dramatic, and it's just a wonderful vocal track. And it sort of, in many ways, sort of epitomises how good the music was, I think, in that era. Also, sort of, it was, at the time, it sort of grabbed a lot of people, and a lot of people went around singing it and stuff like that. It was also a big popular hit, as well as a sort of hit with mods and a hit on the soul scene. And I just thought it encapsulated the time, really. No, no, I can't
Stay With Me Baby by Lorraine Ellison there. Ali, we now move to the 1970s and some big moments in your life. You went to university, the start of a career in social work as well, and you obviously got married to your wife as well at the same time. What was it like at university for you?
I was very lucky at university because the course I did, in fact, was a sandwich course. So I did two terms at university and then a work placement. And they weren't prearranged because a lot of the students were seconded and so on from organisations. But I just went there on a grant. And by chance, I got placed in local government social service departments. And that's what started off my work, which I'll talk about in a minute. But socially, university was great. The education was great. I went to Brunel in Uxbridge, and it's quite a radical course. So it was different. It wasn't straight down the line. I did social science, and it was very interesting. I was very taken with it. But also, it was a time when I was diagnosed with RP, retinitis pigmentosa, and that was an interesting personal experience as well for me.
Did you struggle at all at university with RP, or was it not as bad at that point?
It wasn't as bad at that point. As with a lot of people, my RP manifested itself by very poor night vision. Although I obviously had tunnel vision, which is another symptom, I didn't realise I had it, so I assumed my vision was normal. But I could see very little in the dark, and dim light particularly was bad. And I started to fall off curbs, step off curbs and trip, and walk into lampposts. And of course, because I was a student, people assumed I was drunk. So there was sort of lighter elements of it, the more dramatic. But actually finding out that something was wrong, my dad was a doctor, and he got me seen by specialists because he realised it wasn't about me being drunk, and they diagnosed the RP. And finding out that something was wrong was actually quite a relief. It sort of made me understand why these odd things were happening to me. So although it was difficult, ironically, it was quite a positive thing. Because then I knew I had a problem, and I could start then to think about managing it.
And your career choice to go into social work, was that a good choice for you at the time?
That was very typical of me. When I finished my degree, I'd done 3 placements in local authority social service departments. And one was working with mentally disabled adults in a day centre, and the other two were in just social work offices. And I came out and I said, the 2 things that I would not do are teaching and social work. And the first job I got was as an education social worker. So that is very typical of me to actually go back on my own decision about what I decided not to do. But I was offered a job in a school and to work with some of the kids with difficulties. And that turned into education social work. And that's where I started out.
And the track that you've chosen is a version that I think some people might not know as well as the one that people would probably know.
Absolutely. It's called Suspicious Minds, and it's by Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter. And it was made hugely popular. It was a huge hit for Elvis Presley. And it was one of his great sort of songs that he always performed, though he didn't do it first. But I've chosen it because it, A, is a wonderful song, and they do a really good, make a very good job of it. But the other thing about it is that it was my move from being totally interested in, if you like, African-American music, soul, rhythm and blues, blues and gospel, into really starting to appreciate country music, and suddenly realizing there's a whole other world of country out there. And this song is performed by a couple of people who are members of a sort of loose-knit group of country musicians who are called the Outlaws. And it was Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Jesse Coulter, and a few other people. And they broke away from the sort of Nashville tradition of rhinestones and everything else and just wanted to do the music. And I just thought they were great. And it sort of marks also the move into, if you like, non-student, more sort of lifelong things like careers. At the end of the 70s, Louise and I got married. We've been together for 12 years by then. We got married and so on. So it represents all of those changes in life, if you like.
We're caught in the trap. I can't walk out. Because I love you too much, babe.
Suspicious Minds there by Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter. And of course, people probably know the Elvis version, but I think that one was perhaps slightly better one for me anyway.
Yes, it's sort of, it's slightly edgy. Elvis is great, but it's almost sort of operatic in a way, and which is fine. But there's just something about that particular version which I just find it's actually very moving.
Now, Ali, we come to the 1980s, a good time for you, with the birth of your son, a promotion at work, and I think your sight loss was getting even worse at this time. And I know you've touched on this before, but why do you think it was such a good thing that your sight loss was deteriorating?
An interesting one. I realised at one point, not that long after our son was born, but a couple of years, when he was a couple of years old, 2 or 3, that my sight was getting very bad, and I was still driving. I had a season ticket for Moorfields Eye Hospital in London and go every year for checks. And at that time, I was going a couple of times a year because I was involved in a lot of their research stuff as well. So I was going along to help out with research into RP, as well as, you know, my own sort of personal development of my RP. And I was told quite confidently by the consultants that I was able to drive, and that was all accepted because I was being tested couple of times a year and so on. But my eyes started to get even worse, and my night vision became very bad, and the tunneling of the RP became worse. And so I stopped driving, and that was a very good thing, because I think if, you know, we tend to carry on doing these things longer than we should. But I just thought, no, I can't drive anymore. It's too dangerous. I'm going to kill somebody. So I stopped. And that was quite a powerful thing, because it was actually telling me that I'd reached a stage with my sight development, if you like, or lack of sight development, that was substantially different from when it was first diagnosed.
Did you find it hard or easy adapting to the sight loss that you were now having?
I suppose I found it was an interesting one, because easy is the wrong word, but it was slightly natural, because to me, my sight loss has been a bit like when you're a child and you're growing up and you don't realise you're getting any taller. And the relative who sees you only at Christmas says to you, oh, haven't you grown? And of course, you don't think you have because you're just, you know, to you, you're the same height. Oneself, one's the same height because your horizon's always in the same place. So I actually hadn't really noticed the sight loss. And then people started to say to me, your sight is actually getting much worse. You know, friends who hadn't seen me for a few months noticed that things are considerably different. And so I realized, I think, you know, it brought it home to me just how much my sight had deteriorated, really probably over the decade. But the pigeons are coming home to roost in terms of reality. But I hadn't actually noticed because I'd lived with it day by day. Mm. And that's how sort of we all operate, isn't it? We sort of think it's normal.
I think you're right there. I think we do. We have certainly, like you and like me, I've had sight loss that's deteriorated over my life. And I think you just get used to it and you get on and you don't notice how bad it's got until somebody tells you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And when somebody tells you, you just think, oh, wow. Because, you know, you obviously respect that they're telling you because they want, you know, they're concerned about you and that you know, is they've noticed. And if they've noticed, it must be, you know, something considerable. So in many ways, although it's often quite a hard message to take, it's a useful message to receive.
Was music still playing a big part in your life at this time?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I've always been obsessed by music since my very early teens, since I was about 12 or 13. And I carried on being obsessed. But what I've found with music is that I keep opening doors and there's more stuff in the next room. But I don't dump what I've already had. I just accumulate more and more in my head and in my interest. So I still love blues and rhythm and blues and gospel and stuff and country from the 70s. And I started to hear other music, and I heard a guy called Salif Keita, who's Malian, and a song by him, and it was just so wonderful. His voice is just so amazing. And I then found out that he, in fact, was living with albinism. He was an albino, albinos often have, you know, problems with sight, and he'd had dreadful problems with sight, which basically meant he had difficulties at school, his education fell apart, he had to give up schooling. So he stayed at home and worked on his parents' land. His parents were sort of Malian nobility and had land. And he broke away from all of that and went and joined a band and became a professional musician, much to his family's horror. And then started performing internationally and everything. And this is from his first international record. It's an album called Sorrow, S-O-R-O. And it's just absolutely wonderful. And his voice is amazing. And that got me into listening to music in other languages and from all around the world.
Sina Sabea there by Salif Keita. Now, Ali, we move to the 1990s, a time when you decided to give up your job with the social work and go freelance. And I wondered, why did you make that particular choice at this particular time and whether your sight loss had a part in the decision?
Very good question. The 80s, as you said, for me was a period of, I got promoted as a social worker, I became a manager. I then became a senior manager in another London borough, and I ran the Child Protection Service and was a senior manager in the department. So the two things were sort of linked. And that worked very well at first, but then, and I got on extremely well with my boss. My boss then became the head of the department, and I got a new boss, and we got on less well. I arrived home one day, one Friday evening, very late. It was right across the other side of London, so it was a two-hour commute. And I came in through the front door late one Friday evening and dumped my briefcase on the hall floor. And my wife took one look at me and she said, your job has a shelf life and you've reached it, which I thought was a very wise thing to say. And I wrote my resignation out that weekend. It was just, I realized that stress and the pressure of running a child protection service when you weren't happy with what was going on within your organisation was just too much. So I quit, and I quit without a job and just decided to go freelance. By this time I'd done getting on for 20 years in local authorities, and I'd had enough of the sort of politics of the small p and, you know, the general stuff that you get in any large organisation. It's not about local government, it's just about organisations, particularly large ones. And I wanted to go out on my own, and doing it with a visual disability was a big gamble because I just didn't know how it was going to work. And obviously, within an organisation, you are relatively supported. But I bit the bullet and went. And it was the best thing I ever did. It was like a great weight had been lifted from my shoulders.
Was it quite hard making that move and going freelance? And as you say, as somebody who's visually impaired, was it more difficult, do you think, or did you find it quite easy?
I think it was difficult in the sense that, A, I had to, it's a word that I used later on in life as well, I had to refocus, which I think is quite a good word to think about when we're visually disabled. And every so often we do have to refocus. I had to sort of change my way of thinking and, for example, recognise that, you know, travelling around, I'm not able to drive, having to go over on public transport or getting cabs, which of course is expensive, makes life a lot more difficult. It makes life, you know, there's always added factors. If you're having to get somewhere on time and, you know, the transport system isn't working, things like that, you know, there's more and more stress. And having to operate with pretty advanced RP in crowds is always difficult because obviously you can't see people from the side and all of these sorts of things. So just even getting around was difficult. But I didn't mind that because I felt strangely free, even though very often I was obviously worried about money and things because I quit, I had no income, and I had to create a new world, a new job. But because it was my own choice, or our choice, it wasn't just myself, it was my family, because it was our choice, I felt I had some element of control of it. And I think that was really important. And in the long run, it worked. So the big gamble at the beginning worked.
And the track that marks this particular area of your life is?
Yeah, I chose this track, which is called Whirly Wall by Eliza Carthy, and it comes from her very early part of her career, because I started to get sort of interested in English folk music and suddenly realised that there's a huge world of music locally in the UK as well as out there in the States and around the world, which I've been listening to avidly for decades. And it was wonderful. And Eliza is a fine, fine musician, and she comes from a folk dynasty. Both her parents are very well-known folk musicians, as her uncles and aunts and most of her family. And she's also got a great voice, and she's a great character. She's a really interesting, very amusing person. And so I just thought it epitomised my move into a different area of music, but also having completed a decade of being self-employed.
Well, the very first wedding as bridesmaid at was on a Saturday. There was plenty of lively fun and likewise sporting and play. The bells was rung and as girls we sung, and to the church we went all. The bride after bed with
the Whirly Whirl there by Eliza Carthy and the Kings of Calicut. And a great folk track, I think, there too. We now come to the 2000s, or the noughties, as some might say. And, Ali, you say that this was a time where you may have done a little bit of refocusing of that life-work balance. And you started DJing quite a lot. You started your show here on Connect Radio. And I wondered why you sort of had a big sort of, I suppose, life balance, work balance change.
I guess it was because I'd been freelance for quite a long time by the turn of the millennium. You know, I'd done a decade, and I'd had to create a job because what I did didn't really exist before. And I, like many freelancers, I did lots of different things, and I really, really enjoyed it. And it was hard work, and I travelled all over the country doing all sorts of different things. But things started to change. I became an expert witness, and I was accredited by the Law Society. So I did a lot of work in the High Court, basically assessing risk, whether children should be returned to their families and so on. And the legal system changed, the legal aid system changed, that was becoming more difficult. And I just decided that I was going to refocus again, because I think refocusing at the beginning of the 90s had given me the freedom to refocus into the end of the first decade of the millennium. And I was working with various groups of people and so on. So I started to concentrate more on doing things such as mentoring and working directly with people in that way. I'd done quite a lot of consultancy work when I was freelance, and I was doing that. And I was shifting away from doing the expert witness and the training. So my work balance changed, and I also became really interested in DJing, which is communicating the music that I love to other people. And I started out doing live DJing, which I still do, and being me mainly in sort of seedy, ill-lit establishments in various back streets of London and various other places. And I travel to Wickley when there's no COVID annually with some friends, and we do a festival in Italy every year. And I've done parties in Italy and stuff like that. And I also started to work with Connect, which I've loved, because again, I can then communicate the music that I love to everybody else. And I really love DJing, both live and on radio. It's very sort of fulfilling. At times it can be quite stressful, because particularly doing live work, of course, I can't see what's going on very well. I can work with very focused lighting on the decks, but I can't see if people are dancing. I have to pick up the vibe on that. But I love doing it.
And I also think that your first grandson arrived during this time, and I wonder how much of the arrival had an effect on that work-life balance change.
Yeah, he arrived, in fact, during lockdown last year in 2020. And it's wonderful, because you realise it's another generation thing. And it's quite an interesting thing that how a new arrival sort of in the family can be sort of such an uplift, because obviously it's also a sign that one is getting older. You know, suddenly you're a grandparent. I mean, who would have thought that I would have been a grandparent? You know, it's great. And it's a sort of real look to the future. You know, new arrivals and families, I think, are, you know, very positive looks towards the future. And that's good. And I tend to be an optimist. You know, I am a half full person rather than a half empty person. And he's confirmation of that, that, you know, that there is a good future out there.
And the track that you've chosen that marks this particular time, what is it?
This is a track by an amazing outfit called Amara Terra, who I describe as my lovely mad Italians. They are mainly southern Italians, all of whom are based in London and have been for many, many years. And about a decade ago, around about 2010, 2011, this group of disparate sort of people from southern Italy got together to sing and perform the folk music of southern Italy, which is known as pizzica. And that's the deep south of Italy, Salento area. And it's very wild, and they are amazing. And their live shows are incredible. They are packed out, they sell out these venues, and they're mainly full of pretty young Italians, sort of roughly between 25 and 35, who go mad for this stuff. And it's quite, the way they perform it is quite, the only way I can describe it is almost punky, although they don't sound punk. It's just, it's very, very free, and they clearly love it. And the audience love it, and I love it. And I DJ their sets, their live sets. And I DJ both Italian folk music, but also a lot of Italian dance music remixes and Italian reggae and all sorts of things around that. And what's known as global beats, which is dance music from all around the world, which is very, very good and very exciting. And the audience love it and just dance and dance and dance. So I love doing it. So they epitomise the sort of wildness of my nature, I think, and also the freedom, but also the continuity of the past and the future.
Fantastic sounds there of the Mara Tara, and hopefully one day we'll all be up dancing again soon, I hope, anyway. Ali, we now come to your final track, the one that you would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Well, the track sort of fits in with my musical taste. I love it. It's a great, great song. And it's Happy. It's by Pharrell Williams. And I just think it's positive. We've now got a new grandson who's now just, you know, starting to develop wonderfully and all of those things. And I think I'm a pretty happy sort of person, generally, and positive. And I just think it's, hopefully, our grandson has made us very happy. It's obviously made his parents, our son and his partner, very happy, his fiance, and everybody's happy about little Felix, whose name means happiness. And so I thought happy is what we should all be and hopefully what everybody will be. So I thought it was a very positive way to end.
Well, thank you, Ali Prince, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Toby.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.